I've been down roads from Churchill to L.A. Met kings of speed and stars along the way. They got stories that the cameras never show. Yeah, the truth behind the fame is what we know. From the saddle to the silver screen glow, fast lanes and punch lines on a late night show. You think you've seen it all, but you don't know the half till the curtain lifts and we all have a laugh. It's not just who they are, it's how they came to be. A little horsepower, a little mystery. It's Hollywood and horsepower, baby. Take a ride where the legends laugh and the engines never hide. From the track to the spotlight, stories unwind. Yeah, the truth's a little wild and one of a kind. Hollywood and horsepower, where the real ones show. Every twist and turn is a tale you didn't know. So pour a drink, sit back, enjoy the show. Where the fast and famous let it all go.
Terrific guest today, somebody I consider a great friend, and you know, we've known each other for quite a while. We're brought to you today by Tony Steak and Seafood in Indianapolis, Cincinnati, Lexington, and Bowling Green. Tony always says there's always room at his table for one more, and I always say dining with Tony isn't just dinner, it's an experience. You owe it to yourself to go. We support two charities on this show that are near and dear to our heart. We don't accept a penny from either one of them. We do this just because we believe in them, both on the human side and the animal side. On the animal side, it's oldfriendsequine.org. Michael Blown and Michael and Diane Blown were the founders of this farm. Entertainment writers from the Boston Globe went on to start a retirement home for thoroughbred and thoroughbred horses, and they've just turned it into really the measure in aftercare that everybody else uses. It's just an amazing organization. They've added on John Nicholson as the CEO and president in the last couple of years. Most people probably know him from the horse park and from working some of the other organizations around Kentucky. So it continues to evolve, continues to grow, and it's a terrific organization. The other one is No Fallen Heroes. No Fallen Heroes was started by friend Matt Wiz Buckley, a former Top Gun graduate, Top Gun instructor, naval aviator, fellow aviator. Matt's a great guy. Him and his wife, Susie, started No Fallen Heroes to help veterans and first responders and their families. They really do great work. They do a terrific job of helping prevent suicide, helping people transition. We're losing way too many veterans, and it's just every life counts. We need to do everything we can to help these people, and it's just a terrific work that those guys do. So oldfriendsequine.org, No Fallen Heroes, take a minute, take a look, and if you can't do a lot, do what you can. Every dollar helps. We are joined today by a very special guest, a gentleman I consider to be a friend and an inspiration I look up to all at the same time. He is, speaking of veterans, we're talking about a West Point graduate, a Army officer, and the founder of West Point Thoroughbreds, which kind of gives it up for anybody in the horse industry. Welcome, Terry Finley. Terry, welcome to the show.
What? Mark, it is so good to be on. I was so happy a couple weeks ago when you appeared in my text string and asked me to come on. So let's go. I'm looking forward to this.
I can't thank you enough. And it is truly an honor. And I have to go back because, you know, you and I met in the most unique way. I don't know if you remember. You probably do because you're one of the sharpest guys I know. But for our listeners, I was standing at Del Mar, I believe. Was it Del Mar or Santa Anita?
I think it was Del Mar. I remember.
I think it was Del Mar. Yeah. And you walked up and said, "I really like your shoes." And we started talking. And I knew who you were. But it was, I mean, for me, it was kind of like having Elvis come up and compliment your outfit. So, I mean,
I do like shoes. I do like shoes. My wife has kind of got me off the kick a little bit. You know, you get a little bit older and you know, it's like you see those older guys and they got sharp shoes. We were as old as we are now overall, Mark.
No,
but I'm always been in the shoes.
But we still wear really good shoes.
Try to. I mean, they're good investments, right? It's like when you go to the sales, you try to get the best possible horse you can. And when you go to the shoe store, you go online, you try to get the best possible shoe as well.
Yeah, and you're a lot like I am. You're looking for something unique, and that's what always stands out. And anybody who knows me knows that I like shoes as well. it was a common thread. Yeah. It was an interesting way to meet, and you've always been very gracious to me, always giving me time, and I can't thank you enough. And I can't thank you enough for taking the time to do this today. So,
yeah,
you know, everybody knows you for the obvious. I mean, West Point Thoroughbreds is like an institution in the horse industry. But I'd like to go back and kind of give people a little bit of a feel for, you know, your life, because I think most people, especially in the horse industry and even outside the horse industry today, probably know you most as the face of West Point. But there's obviously a lot to Terry that happened before West Point. So, tell us a little bit about growing up and, you know, how you became interested in horses.
Yep. So my father was a school teacher. He taught for, you know, 36, 37 years or so, had seven kids. My mother was a homemaker. And I was the last of seven. So
wow.
That provided me a chance to go to the races a little bit more and to spend more than a little bit more time with my father. You know, you could imagine what the first six had with a teacher's salary back then. They still don't make even close to what they should make. But
sure.
Back then it was even worse than it is now.
No, I was thinking the same thing. I was trying to figure out how he raised a family on a teacher's salary. I mean, that's pretty impressive.
Well, who knows, right? He did refereeing and but I think a lot of his refereeing money went to the races because he always loved to go for the last two. At that time, it was at Keystone and at Liberty Bell. And so you could go for the last two. And the reason a lot of people went was because you got in free after the seventh race. So you could watch the eighth and the ninth race.
So where was home? Where did you guys grow up?
Right outside of Philadelphia, a place called Levittown, Pennsylvania, which is one of the first suburbs that came into being in the country.
Wow.
So I just fell in love with the racetrack. And I ended up, when I was a young kid, ended up getting a chance to get around them. And I worked, I walked hots, I rubbed horses, you know, I traveled all over the place with them. And I worked for some really good guys. So it kind of gave me a chance to see how enthralling and how captivating this business was and still is. In a lot of ways, it's still very, very, you know, at its core, it's captivating. And in my mind, I always said, like, if I ever got a shot to stay in the business or to be reintroduced to the business, I was going to take it. And so that's what happened. I went to West Point. I graduated in 1986.
So was that always a dream also? Did you aspire to go to West Point from a young age?
Yeah, Mark, I didn't. My father was in the Navy in World War II, but none of my brothers and sisters were associated with the military. What happened was I played football. I was a decent, not even a good football player, but solid enough. And there was a kid that was 2 years ahead of me a kid by the name of Brian Goodrow, who's like 6'4", like 240, and, you know, was probably would have been not a walk-on at a place like Penn State, but Penn State was looking at him and a couple other good schools. But he ended up going to the Naval Academy, and I just thought that was the coolest thing. And so in the back of my mind, I was like, wow, what could I do to get to one of the academies? And they were all in play. And I ended up getting into West Point. I didn't get into the Naval Academy, but so that took me right about this time in the summer of 1982 up to West Point for a summer, you know, the first summer. It's called Beast Barracks. And that's the introduction that you have when you go to West Point as a plebe. So
I was Navy. So Navy was always plebe summer. So same thing.
Yeah. Plebe summer. Absolutely. So I just, you know, I'd go to the races with some friends. I always loved it. But of course, as the years went by, it got a little further and further away. And I always point out, we lived in Germany for my first duty assignment with my wife. And we'd go to Frankfurt to either leave or to pick somebody up or to come back. And when you drove out of Frankfurt, out of the airport, there was an old racetrack. I don't know if it's even still there, but it was really something. Because, you know, you'd go up there four or five times a year for in one direction or the other. And I just remember, like, wow. And it
take you right back to your youth. Yeah,
exactly. Kept the dream alive. So anyway, we came back in 1990 and we were getting ready to get out. I was going to go into the corporate world, which, you know, a lot of young officers, right, junior officers do. That's a whole ecosystem. A lot of big companies that love to attract and train and retain young officers. And I had a job offer at Johnson & Johnson, a division of J&J called Ethicon. And it just didn't work out. You know, we got extended because of the war at the beginning of the 90s. I didn't go to war, but I trained horses. I trained troops. I was a basic training company commander. And
back stateside, or were you still in Germany training?
No, I was at stateside. I was a place called Fort Dix, New Jersey.
Oh yeah, real famous.
And
yeah,
yeah. So that basically gave me a chance to be in the area in the Mid-Atlantic. It gave me a chance to get reintroduced to the racetrack, and all of a sudden I was like, you know, I'm glad I didn't realize how dumb I was, but I was like, I had two kids and I was like, I want to give this a try, see if I can work. Now, at that time, keep in mind that partnerships were starting to really accelerate in the industry. You had Todd Gamble, you had Team Valor, you had Centennial. So there were a couple local ones. I mean, certainly not nearly as many as there are now, but they were starting to be more of a, and play more of a role in the industry in the early 90s. And so we basically,
not to interrupt, but to kind of, and we're joined by Terry Finley, for people just joining us, West Point Thoroughbreds. For people that don't know, or people that are outside of racing, you know, explain a little bit about the difference between like a partnership or syndication and a, like some of these club things. Because I think a lot of people don't understand the ownership side of it that well.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think both entities, let's start out how they're similar, Mark. Like, both entities bring people into the business, which we
absolutely,
we really need, right? We sorely need. So I have a lot of admiration for the clubs, in particular, the My Racehorse Gang. It's really interesting. I remember Michael Behrens.
And we actually had them as a guest on the show a few weeks ago, Michael Behrens. And I agree, you know, high tide raises all boats. I'm just trying to, I think a lot of people don't realize that some people just own the whole horse, you know, and then there's people that own a quarter, and then there's people that own three hairs on their tail, but it still gives you an opportunity to get involved. And there's, I guess there's a path for everyone.
There is. And that's been very, very positive. You know, we kind of shuddered to think what racing would be like without the proliferation of the partnerships. You know, if we still relied on the one person owning 50 horses instead of 50 people owning one horse. But
how did you come
it is
up
what it is.
With the idea? How did it hit you to say, go for the partnership side versus just doing it on your own?
Well, I mean, money had a big part had a big part to play in that, right? But I was just coming out of the army. But I think the biggest impact, Mark, was the fact that my brother and my father, when I was probably in the eighth or ninth grade, they got into a partnership that was just starting. And it was just a businessman who loved the horses. And it was really the precursor of the, you know, of the rapid acceleration. But basically they ended up with a filly who won like three in a row, you know, at a cheaper level. I think she was a $10,000 claimer, but they just had a wonderful time with it. And I could see, I just remember the enthusiasm and the adrenaline rush that my brother, and in particular, my father had. So that kind of stuck in my mind. I loved horses. I saw what it did for my brother and my father. And I didn't feel a gravitational pull to the corporate world. So I was like, what's the universe trying to tell me? And I thought it was trying to tell me that I should take a shot. And so that's what I did. And I say, anytime I see I'll talk about my wife, Debbie. She's my high school sweetheart. We've been together since the 10th grade. And, you know, you could imagine not every woman, not every wife would have a husband come home at 26 years old with two kids and say, I want to get into the horse racing business. I want to run a partnership. After being in, you know, 8 years in the military with a secure, you know, housing and medical and everything else all covered. But
yeah, that's a big step.
Yeah, I give her all the credit in the world. And that's what we did. We started out with one horse and at Parks. At that time, it was Philadelphia Park, and I had no idea what to do. I just, you know, I started to try to do some advertising and all different kinds of things. I ran some small ads in the back of the Blood Horse. If you remember, the Blood Horse had classified advertising.
Absolutely.
As did the racing form. And so that's what I did. I basically, I just,
you know,
I just stayed at it.
It's not like you're going to put it out on a social media or something. At that time, that was your best avenue to get some exposure.
Absolutely. And you talk about social media. It was funny. The guy who did all my advertising in the Blood Horse was a guy by the name of Harry Miller. And Harry Miller was a Vietnam vet. And it took a little bit of a shine to me. And one day, at like probably in 1993, he calls me and he says, hey, Terry, I was just at a meeting and they came up with this, or they introduced this thing to me called the World Wide Web. And they asked me if I had any clients who might be interested in going down the path of looking at it. And I brought your name up. And would you mind talking to them? And so that was at the very beginning of the internet. And a woman called me, and we started talking. And like a couple months later, we had an internet site, and I believe it was one of the first ones in the industry.
Wow.
In probably the middle of 1993. And so about a year later, we were able to update our horses. I used to have to fax the updates. We had six or seven horses then. I would have to fax them all to the blood horse, and they would have to type in my updates. Well, we got this, an extension or whatever it was, and it turned out that we could do it ourselves. And that was really the start of really getting me interested in technology and me seeing how technology could really help a business like ours try to get a little bit of an edge. And so that was almost 35 years ago. So today we celebrate 35 years this year.
Wow, that's amazing. And, you know, the it's impressive, too, that I did. That's something I didn't realize is that you guys were one of the cutting edge for using, you know, web and social media to promote it, which today is just, you know, second nature to all of us. You don't think about it. But that's pretty impressive that, because I remember those days. I remember that
sure,
when it first came out, it was a little cumbersome, not the most user-friendly. You know, you had to kind of stumble through it a little bit, but it was still, I remember at the time being just mesmerized with it. And I was kind of like you, I was always taken by technology. You know, I'm not archaic, but you know, I wasn't, you know, I didn't grow up with it in schools. You know, I mean, about the most advanced technology we had in school was typewriter. So, I mean, that came mm-hmm. after. So I didn't learn it like a lot of people do, but I remember forcing myself, like I went and bought a laptop, and this will show my ignorance, especially at the time, took it home, learning how to operate it, and I couldn't remember how he told me the sequence to turn it, power it down. So I put it back in the car and drove back to the store with it open and running. The guy showed me how to power it down.
That's so funny.
I think about it today.
Yes. Yeah, technology has had a huge impact on our generation, to say the least.
Yeah, and it definitely has helped our industry. I mean, the horse industry has really adopted it. I think, you know, it's interesting. You know, I had a conversation earlier this week. I'm sure you remember Ursel Ellis. He hosted Horse Tales, and I'm sure you've been on his show. And you know, Ursel mm-hmm. passed this year, and he was kind of one of my mentors. You know, him, Mike Penna, Steve Bick. There's a lot of guys I looked up to in this realm. And we talked about that a little bit, that, like, you know, Ursel's show came at a time when that was the only avenue to get your race results that day. Like, he would host right. a show that was on AM stations from 5 to 7. And otherwise, you had to wait till the next day when the newspapers came out to get the race results.
Yeah.
So it definitely changed to where now, you know, you get everything real time. You can watch a race on your phone. You know, it's really changed. It's been a game changer. So it's, you know, you guys are leading edge, you know, you and your wife, and you did touch on a point that's really poignant. I mean, it's like, it's crazy that, so you guys obviously got married. Well, were you still at the academy when you got married?
No. Great
you
question.
Got married after you graduated?
We couldn't be married. You weren't allowed to be married.
Oh, they wouldn't allow you to back then. Okay.
Yeah. Yep. So, in fact, there was one guy I remember. He must have. I think it went to Mexico for Christmas and ended up getting married down there, and he came back, and they had to kick him out. You couldn't be married. So I felt bad because it wasn't intentional. He just, I don't, you know, it's just not something that people talk about a lot, but you know, the guy just made a tactical error. So,
well,
no, we got married.
Different world. My dad was a Detroit cop. My dad was Navy World War II, like your dad. And then he came back and was a Detroit cop. I remember him telling me you had to get your commander's permission to get married as a policeman.
Yes. Yep. Yeah, it's crazy, right? It's
so much, much different world. But to your point, you know, I like hearing those stories because it's amazing how many times you hear about, you know, sounds like a cliche, but like the power couple. It's like without that support, you know, there's no way you could have done what you did. And there's so many like that. I mean, I even experienced that myself. You know, I have a kind of a long-term relationship. Margie, she's absolute rock behind me. And same thing, I'm sure, for you. I'm sure, same thing, I'm sure, you know, Michael Blowen, his story's very famous. I remember him saying, you know, when he went to Diane and said he was going to start old friends, he said, I want to move to Kentucky. And I'm sure you've heard this. I want to move to Kentucky and start a farm for retired racehorses. And she said, let me think about it. She comes back to him and she's, and they're living in Boston. They had a really good life. He was the entertainment writer for the Boston Globe. She was a syndicated columnist worldwide. I mean, she was very accomplished. Most people don't realize how accomplished Michael Blowen's wife was. Excellent writer and a very, very well-known columnist worldwide. And she says to him, I'll go with you, but on one condition. And he said, what's that? And she said, when I leave you, you don't come looking for me.
Yeah,
he looked at her and he said, deal. And to this day, he's told that story a million times. But no, the point is, though, it's so critical to have that support. I mean, one of the things you learn in the military, I learned, you learned, is, you know, teamwork is everything. And that applies to your relationship as well. You've got to be a team or it just doesn't go. And my dad used to say, there's nothing better than a good relationship, and there's nothing worse than a bad one.
Nope. So true. So true.
Well, that's the piece behind West Point. So you guys start West Point, you and your wife, takes off. You got one horse running at parks. You're starting to get some traction. How did you grow, and where was your first, like, where did you really feel like, okay, this thing's going to really go?
Yeah. So I'll talk about that in a bigger picture. I think one of the things, because, you know, a lot of people ask me that question. And Mark, and I tell them, like, I think that's probably been one of the things that's really helped us, is I've never felt comfortable in turn. Now, let me explain that. I've never felt comfortable in the sense that, like, you never truly arrive in this business. And the reason is because you could end up having a really strong stable, as good of a stable as you've ever had. And literally in a month, the situation could change as dramatically as you could ever imagine. You know, they get hurt, trainers go on hot, you know, cold streaks. So I think when you ask that question, it always perks me up. Like, when did you think that you arrived? And I'm not trying to be cute here. I'm just saying, like, this business is structured in a way that if you ever think you arrive, you're in big trouble. Like,
I agree with that. I would even expand on that. I think that applies to a lot of businesses. I've never felt like that. You know, it's funny because people will, and you'll appreciate this. People outside will always say things to you, and like, you know, oh, you're doing really great. I never really feel that way, and I'm sure I completely understand what you're saying. And for our listeners,
I think you would.
I think the other thing most people don't realize, and you touched on it, that's really, really key. What you do is so critical. There are so many pieces to it. You know, it's unlike any other sport in my mind. You know, you have a jockey, you have a horse, you have a trainer, you have an exercise rider, you have the track, you have the distance, the surface, the weather, all these, and then just the overall health of all those people and animal. And if anything is off, it's not going to click. And there's stories all through history where, you know, they switched a trainer or switched a jockey or switched a surface or a track, and all of a sudden they're firing on all cylinders. And that is, I've always said, the one thing that's always been impressive to me about this industry, especially coming from the outside, is how you have an athlete that you can't communicate with. You have to figure out what they're thinking, feeling, without them telling you. I mean, they tell you in their own way. Not like they can walk up and say, I'd really do better if you did this.
Yeah.
And they don't know. I completely understand what you're saying.
Absolutely. They don't all tell you in exactly the same way. So three different horses could tell you the exact same thing in three different ways.
1,000%. Right? If that makes I've seen sense. That myself being around old friends. You have horses that will, you can tell every thing they're feeling. If it was a person, you'd say they wear their feelings on their sleeve. And then you have horses that could be sick and don't even show signs. I mean, they've had horses there at old friends that would be running a fever, and it wouldn't be until somebody just kind of caught a little something and started checking deeper that it's like, oh my gosh, there's something going on here. But they did not tip you off that something, you know, they wouldn't, you're absolutely right. Their personalities are very, very different. Their personalities are very, very different in racing. I remember when War Emblem came to old friends, he had a reputation that he just would not do anything he didn't want to do. My understanding is that's why he quit racing. They just couldn't get him to do anything. And that was also why he quit breeding. They said when they would take him, they even tried natural, turning him out in a paddock with a mare, and he would just lay down. He just literally refused to do anything he didn't want to do. So, yeah, every one of them is different, and you've got to figure that out as an owner and a trainer.
Yes. And that's, you know, just like anything, there are better surgeons. Well, why is this surgeon better than the other? They went through the exact same training. They had the exact same background. Well, there's an innate talent that some people have, and I think it applies to training racehorses. Now, the difference is that much of their success is dependent on the horses that get off the van and walk into their barn every spring and summer, i.e. the two-year-olds. So I find that's a fascinating part of the business. I do feel the plight of the modern day racehorse trainer is very, very different than it was. And I'll offer you much, much tougher, especially with stats. You know, stats are in the racing form. Everybody talks about stats, and it's really put most trainers, very few trainers, very few, if any, are in a position where they can look past their stats that are published every day. And that was never the case up until, I'd say, 20 years ago. And so
And, you know, what's interesting about that is that you see that in a lot of industries. And I've got a common phrase that I use is, you know, sometimes people overanalyze. They get too focused on the numbers. And I've actually made the comment, you know, you can get to a point where it's paralysis by analysis. You can't make a decision because you're so consumed with the data that, you know, in some ways I think people did better. I remember asking my dad one time, and you know, anybody that knows me knows I mention stories of my dad a lot. He was probably one of the wisest guys that I knew. And I would always ask him, I'd say, you know, he was one of those guys that seemed like they were 10 feet tall and bulletproof. And I would say, how come, and I was an adult, you know, I had a family, and I'm sitting there, I'm like, how come you always seem to know what to do? You know, I was dealing with some challenge, a decision I had to make, and he looked at me and says, didn't know what to do. He said, you make a decision, if that doesn't work, you make another one.
Yes.
And there's something to be said for that. You know, there was a different approach 20 years ago. And I don't get me wrong. That is very, very useful. But you kind of have to mix that with some common sense and experience, too.
Yeah, you do. Yeah, you do. And you talked about, Mark, the number of hands that touch any one horse. And it is a massive number of people and hands that touch horses.
Absolutely.
And I think when people ask me, and I kind of talk about, you know, kind of the vision that I've had and that my team has had, I think about especially the trainer relationship that, you know, we don't fire trainers on a regular basis, right? And I know that there are some people and some owners that fire on a much more regular basis than the majority of other owners, and that's their prerogative, right? I don't have any. That's their prerogative. They put their money up. They either earn their money or they inherited their money, one or the other, or a combination, and they buy horses and they can do with whatever they want with the asset that is their stable. But I think one thing people don't, owners, it takes them a while if they ever learn. Like, you're dealing with people, you're dealing with trainers, you're dealing with their staffs. And if you basically don't have their backs, right, you will not get as much out of your horses as they were destined to get. And what do I mean by that? I mean, like, I want my guys thinking outside the box. I want my trainers to be thinking about taking shots and doing stuff that, you know, especially now, that might cause some chatter on Twitter. Well, we don't care about Twitter. We care about our horses. And so you see where I'm going here. Like, I think that's helped me. And I do think trainers appreciate it when they're not second guessed and they put a rider on, they don't put IRAD on. There's been a horse, we had a horse that was out 9 months. Well, that's probably not a horse you put IRAD on because he can read the racing form. Now, he might not be a good example because he rides everything like it's the Kentucky Derby, but sure. You get what I'm saying. You might not ride a top rider. You might use, I don't know, Jamie Rodriguez, who's going to be a star, but we've had good luck with him, but he rides the hair off of every horse. But those nuances, right?
I tell well, my personalities. Friends, I think that's something that people don't give enough credit to. And that's something I heard another really famous trainer say one time is one of the toughest things is matching the personalities. They're like, you know, totally. Once I get a jockey, energy, exercise rider, and the horse that kind of click, that's when things start happening. But, you know, they're like, you know, you can go down through the racing form and look at horse after horse after horse that, you know, their first four races were kind of, you know, not the best results. Maybe they were third, maybe they were fourth, whatever, just not quite there. And then all of a sudden they switch jockeys and all of a sudden, boom, it's there. And I remember one time I had a lunch with Pat Day. I was fortunate enough that he, through old friends, met him, and him and I went and sat down and had lunch. And I was talking to him about it, and I said, you know, what were some of the things you learned? He says, you know, the biggest thing I learned was to let the horse tell me when it was time to go. He said, my job wasn't to get him to the finish line. And he said something really interesting. He said, my job was to conserve energy. He said, I guided him and conserved energy. But at the end of the day, he goes, the horse would tell me, and he used a very well-known It was Ali Sheba. And he said, one time, and I don't remember the race, but he said, I thought we were done. You know, we're coming up on the finish line. We're lengths ahead of second place horse. And he said, I'll be honest, I stood up in the stirrups, something you never do. And he said,
yeah,
all of a sudden, he took off. And he said, I had to grab his mane to keep from falling off the back. And he said, I look under my arm, and the horse is closing. We were going to get beat. And the horse knew it. And the horse took off to win the race. And he said, so I learned the lesson that, like, I needed to tune into the horse and really understand that. And it was amazing. I know Gary Stevens has said the same thing. Mike Smith said the same thing. It is definitely, and the reason I bring this up is I think for a lot of our listeners, and a lot of our listeners are in and out of horse racing, but for a lot of people, I don't think they realize how much that has an effect on the results. Those personalities, trainer personalities. You know, I'm kind of like on the edge of the industry, so I'm kind of floating around all over the place. And one of the things that's always stood out to me, and I remember this very clearly at like Belmont a few years ago, was walking around the shed rows, and some barns are like very quiet, very calm. And in the next barn, it's like the horses are restless. The people are kind of yelling back and forth. You could see a difference in the energy barn to barn. And you could also see a difference in the race results with those people.
Yes.
And it was really something that stood out to me. It's like, wow. And they're, because I remember, you know, there was a conversation I had with somebody one time. They're like, you know, that this is different than any other sport. You know, there's fans for the horse, there's fans for the jockey, there's fans for the owner, there's fans for the track. Sometimes there's fans for that particular race. You know, there's guys that go to the Jim Dandy every year or go to the Travers every year. So if you don't appeal to all those people, you're leaving something. You're missing something.
Yeah, you are. Yep.
And I think sometimes people forget that. We have a unique sport.
Yeah, we do. We do. When you're talking about Pat Day, you know, he's obviously friends with just about everybody in the business. Everybody has the utmost respect for him. He tells a story very, very similar to what you talked about. He tells a story that he says, you know, he got off of a horse one day and the owner came up to him in kind of a little bit of a belligerent, with a little bit of an attitude, in a belligerent manner. And he said, I thought I told you to go to the lead at the start. And Pat just took a deep breath. He said, I wanted to stay with my horse. So that's it. I wanted to stay with my horse. If I went to the lead, I wasn't going to be with him. I was going to be by myself. But yeah, that's a lot of things. But that's what, you know, we just talked for a couple minutes about all the different things and just a small sliver. That's what keeps everybody, our dreams alive. We're hoping for that big one. And
but you brought up something really poignant, and I think, you know, you got to give yourself a little more credit, because you talked about giving people the latitude to take a shot, make, you know, try something without the fear of criticism. And, you know, how much a trainer would appreciate that. I think anybody would appreciate that. I don't care if it's a
guy, you're right,
you know, working on the, you know, raking the aisle, to a guy that, there's something to be said for making someone believe that you believe in them, you know, and there, that is, I don't know. I mean, I can't speak for you, but I can speak for myself. I'm sure that that's a lot of the strength that you gain from your wife, even. I mean, that's the one person that, you know, you know, if she believes in you, I know I've been like that with Margie. It's like sometimes she'll have more confidence in what I'm doing than I do.
Totally. Totally. And they might not always clearly communicate that, right? And but they're always there for us. So
yeah, but it is a thing. You know, the point is with anybody, whether it's a partner or an employer or, you know, a business partner, there's something to be said for that trust, that confidence. You know, I mean, yep. It's like, and that's something that, you know, I'm Italian, and I mean, in Italians, it's like loyalty and trust is a big deal. You know, it's like if you don't have that, you don't have anything. So, I mean, put a lot in that. So, I mean, yeah, what you're talking about is like, that's paramount. And I do believe that that breeds success, because then people have the confidence that if they're thinking something, whether it's a trainer or a jockey or whatever, whoever it is in the process, if they're thinking, you know, I really think if we did this, it might help, they're going to try it. Where if they're concerned about getting criticized, and you touched on something with Pat, you know, you remember the late Randy Romero. Randy was a good friend of mine, and, you know, excellent jockey, great guy, and really good friend. I mean, I was very close to Randy, talked to him all the time. And he told me horror stories about guys trying to beat him up after races, you know, throwing him around. You know, you got to remember, most jockeys aren't very big people. You know, and the owner comes down and he's mad. I told you to do this. I told you to do that. And, you know, it's like, it could be, you know, that's the other side. So if you take a guy who has some talent and you trust him and say, look, I believe in you. I really do. I want you to, you tell me what you think, what you're thinking. That's big. That has a lot of power.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it does. Yeah, it does. And, yeah, no, you touch upon a great point, Mark. Human nature is human nature, right? Doesn't matter where you're at in the world. Doesn't matter what you, what industry you're in. When you know you have people who have your back and they have confidence in you, and you're much more likely to perform. Look, you might not have the talent, and you might not make great decisions. And at a certain point, that has to be addressed, right? But if they're on your team, they're on your team. So that's what you're talking about. And I think that goes a long way. It's just, you look and see, that's never talked about in our business. Like, and you know, you think about the vibe, like, you know, every trainer, and I don't care who you are, Chad Brown just lost a group of horses from, you know, he just lost it. And everybody from him to the guy who's got two horses, like there's owners know that. They know that they basically can make one phone call and the van is there in the next morning. So it's good. It's good. I just wish more owners would own the fact that your trainer's on your team. Your trainer is your field coach. And the more you take care of them and the more you support them, both in private and in public, the better it is. And but look,
completely agree.
It just takes all kinds. And a lot of these things go out the window when you have a fast horse. Right, Mark? When you have a fast horse. Now, To a certain extent.
No, you're absolutely correct. I mean, it's kind of like anything else. You know, I used to have an old, you know, when I've always been in sales and marketing. And I remember I had an old sales manager that would always say, like, you know, nothing a couple of good sales won't correct. You know?
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of amazing how positive results improve anything. So, yeah, there is something to that. And you're absolutely right. You've got to have the results along with it. But, you know, I really believe sometimes that's how you get the results, is giving that person the latitude and letting them know you support them. Sometimes that's where you pull a guy out and he does something great. I mean, everybody knows the Seabiscuit story, and that's probably one of the most biggest, you know, lessons of that was, you know, the trainer wasn't like a real high profile trainer at the start of that. The owner was considered kind of, you know, crazy. And they put together one of the most winning teams there was. Jockey was kind of wild card. I mean, I think when they first started showing up, people were laughing at him. And they weren't laughing when they were staring at Seabiscuit's tail going down the track. You know, I mean, it's like there's something to be said for believing in somebody. And there's something to be said because sometimes that gives them the ability to believe in themselves.
Yep. I'll give you a funny story about Seabiscuit. I'll give you a funny story. So do you remember in Seabiscuit, they had the scenes, they were like the nighttime scenes at Saratoga?
Yeah.
Does that ring a bell? Well, yeah, it's a beautiful.
When they were running on the track, you could see the lights on the track.
The lights on the track. Yeah, what a beautiful scene. Anyway, I don't know how long they spent. I think they spent like 2 weeks up here with the film crew and all the actors. So Tobey Maguire was the jock, obviously, of Seabiscuit. Well, it turns out that before I bought my house at Saratoga, I bought my house in 2008, the film company, they rented the house from the previous owner for like 2 weeks. And that house was occupied by Tobey Maguire. So, oh, wow. So Tobey has slept in my bed. Now we since changed the bed entirely, but my wife always chuckles. She said I slept in the same bed as Tobey Maguire. So, who I haven't seen in a long time, but it just as an aside, it's you know, it's a funny thing, but that was a great movie. Really was. That was down in history. It's one of the
funny
best.
One with that. So, you know, Gary Stevens was in there, played George Wolfe.
Oh, of course. Yeah.
And Popcorn Delight was the horse that played one of the horses that played Seabiscuit that was retired to Old Prince. Popcorn was actually, according to Gary, I'm just repeating the story. Gary always said, Popcorn was probably the one you saw most in the scenes because nothing fazed him. Now, he said the downside was he was so slow that they had to wear out the other horses to get him to win. Like, they couldn't, they kept shooting the scenes over because they couldn't get him to win without making it look obvious. So they kept trying to wear out
the horses. The guy that couldn't shoot straight, yeah.
Yeah. But here was one of the funny stories that Gary told. So, you know, when they'd show the old looking footage, they created some of that. And they used like these old cameras that had these huge thick glass lenses. Well, one of the things Gary said was these old movie cameras, when they were exposed to heat, sometimes would like explode. Basically, the glass would blow out of them. And I guess they were shooting one of the winner's circle scenes, and they had the horse there and the whole crowd, and the camera explodes from the heat, and everybody, like, you know, ducks down, hits the ground, and he said the horse didn't even blink. He says the horse was so kind of like just nothing fazed him that he just stood there. So he said that was kind of why you saw him the most in all of the film. But
yeah,
no, it was it's, you know, it's interesting, and that's another thing I think that's kind of fun about this industry. It's interesting how many times movies of all different kinds have involved horse racing, more so years ago, but even some of the modern ones like Secretariat, Seabiscuit, you know, when they shot them at Saratoga and Belmont and Keeneland and Santa Anita, and they used people from the industry. I know when you look at the Secretariat movie, look up in the crowd, especially that last race, you know, where they portray winning the Belmont. I mean, there's a ton of people you recognize from the horse industry that they used as extras.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
So it was kind of like, it's, you know, kind of fun. And
everybody got their,
everybody got their SAG card out of that deal.
Yes. Absolutely.
So you guys are, you know, rolling along. I mean, what's next for West Point? Where are you guys, you know, guiding it? I know you, you know, this keeps continuing to do the same thing, but there's always new things.
Yeah, that could, I was thinking that we'd probably get to this question, right? And I think it's, you know, we could probably do another show on that. I think I'm 62, so I started, this is our 35th year, and they're just numbers, right? I still really enjoy it. I'm fascinated by the pursuit of trying to outwit and out-hustle and outsmart people with the resources that dwarf us. And I know we dwarf some people too, but it's all an ecosystem, right? But you know, you're
Sure.
not going to outmoney. There's several entities that you simply cannot and will not and should not try to outmoney in this business. So what am I getting at? I think the beautiful thing about a business is it really is about getting to the winner's circle, right? And we know that it's a very difficult investment. And if you only come in and look at the financial ROI and not the lifestyle ROI, you're in trouble because you're probably going to lose unless you get very, very lucky. And you know, the people that I know that have gotten very lucky, they've just taken their profits and try to do it again. So it's a little bit of a vicious cycle like that, but it's a vicious cycle that we all enjoy playing. Obviously the business is in there are perils that are facing the business right now. You know, we basically, I think, are looked at as a relic of the past by a decent portion of the population. And so I think more and more about the business, the industry. And I know it's easy to say. I think about the young people. I think about my daughter who works in the company and, you know, my grandkids, and that number is going to be six in the middle of September.
Oh,
So
congratulations.
thank you. But the point being like, you know, you basically, I vacillate between, you know, looking at Twitter, which I do like one time a week, and getting sucked into commenting about all the leadership failures, I guess the leadership failures, and all the problems that people continuously to identify with, while or on the other side saying like, hey, how can I do my part, right? And how can I be part of an evolution and not a revolution? Because I think some people are looking at a revolution. Revolutions do not work and cannot work in an industry like ours. It has to be an evolution. So when you ask me what's next, like I understand. I basically have been blessed, and this industry has been very, very good to me, very good to my family. We have 15 employees. They're all well compensated. Everybody gets to do what we love. And that being said, we definitely all believe that we owe it to the industry to give back. And so what does that mean? That means, you know, taking care of the people, the batch workers, being part of the progress of aftercare. I get that. And really growing our fan base and our betting base. And so how does that happen? Well, there's no magic wand, and anybody that goes on online and starts to beat everybody up and calls everybody idiots and thinks that they're the smartest guy in the world and that they can fix everything. Well, show me the beef. Show me where we're going and lay out a roadmap. And there are a couple guys that I've said exactly that to. I said that to their face. Lay out the roadmap. If it makes sense and you truly believe it and you've put your heart and soul right behind it, you're going to have plenty of followers because people love this business. They want it to get better. They want it to prosper. So I think we all just need to take a deep breath, and we all need to realize, like, listen, we're struggling just like a lot of other sports are struggling and a lot of other industries are struggling. it's really about, that leadership. I know about leadership. I think I went to a pretty good leadership school.
Yeah,
leadership is day by day by day. If you think you can write a tweet and just call yourself a leader or a commissioner, come on, man. Come on, get with it. Like, so leadership is day by day by day. It's building esprit de corps. It's building unity. It's being respectful. It's, really, right, putting your outlook on paper, but you have to support it. You just can't get mean-spirited for somebody who has an opposing view or a slightly different view. So you see where I'm going here, right? It's like Mike Rapoli and others, like when they talk about the Jockey Club, well, look at the transformation of the Jockey Club and the Board of Stewards. I'm proud to be on the Board of Stewards of the Jockey Club. If you look at when I first became interested in the affairs of the Jockey Club, I was an early believer in HISA. Right. So that was probably 2015. So I've been following it for a while. And the whole organization has changed. In particular, look at the demographic and the composition of the Board of Stewards. For the first time in over 50 years, there's not a Phipps that is at the helm. We have a great guy from Oklahoma, Everett Dobson, who actually owns a pretty good basketball team, who was able to raise the world championship trophy above his head in 2025. And you got Vinny Viola, who's been able to raise the Stanley Cup twice and bought a franchise, the Florida Panthers, in 2013. That was, I think, by and large, looked at as the worst professional sports entity or franchise in the whole world. In a span of 10 years, they've won two Stanley Cups. So for somebody to insinuate that we don't have any leadership and we don't have any smarts, I get it. Like, nobody's happy with the status of the business and how it's contracted and how tough it is, especially for trainers and jocks and owners on the smaller scale. I get that. But leadership is important here. And if you have the voice and you have the pulpit, like some people do in our industry, I just bring up leadership. Leadership isn't just about saying everybody's an idiot and I'm a leader, so follow me. No, leadership is day by day by day.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you 1,000%. And it's funny, I think a lot of people have the perception that leadership or being in charge is like you kind of said, it's about, barking orders or being mean. I've had leadership roles in most of my career. Most people know the sales and marketing and partnerships, building, brands and things. And I always, I was very fortunate that I met the right people at the right times. And I've been as high as senior vice president with a couple of large companies, 9,000 employees. But one of the things that my dad always taught me, again, one of my dadisms, he says, God gave you two ears and one mouth for a reason. Listen more, speak less. And he said, the other thing, and this is something that always stuck with me, he said, you treat everybody with respect and kindness, and you listen to everyone, because you never know where that idea is going to come from. And it might be the most unlikely guy, the guy sweeping the floor that says, what do we do? Why don't we try this? And you look at him and think, that's perfect. But the other thing I always looked at was, and I'm getting to a point, I apologize, I'm wandering, but one of the things I always looked at was, I always looked at my role wasn't to push people around. My role was to keep the debris off them so they could do their job and to believe in them, what we were talking about earlier, to give them the confidence to do their job. I was really big with, and it's interesting. I've had people that have worked with me through four different companies, people that have become personal friends for over 20 years. I really take that as my greatest accomplishment, to be honest, besides my kids. I feel the most proud of that, that somebody was willing to follow me and go with me. You know, you got to remember, these are people's families. These are their well-being. And they're willing to put the confidence in you. So I felt like I owed it to put the confidence in them and treat them, give them everything I could so that they could succeed. My job wasn't to push them around. My job was quite the opposite. My job was to clear the path and make it. And that's something that I feel frustrated with our industry. It feels like there's too much infighting. It's like we get attacked more from the inside, you know, than we do the outside.
Yeah. So to your point, I'll say it. Like, I think everybody should get to a point, especially the guys that are very active on Twitter. Stop bringing up Stuart Janney. Like, nobody's opinion is going to be changed on Stuart Janney. I know one thing. I'm not a dumb guy. I've seen him at work, and I don't have any business with him. I don't need to, you know, he's off of the board of stewards. He's not involved in the Jockey Club any longer. And I think he's done some very, very good things. I think without Stuart Janney, Heise is not in play. Now, do I understand that there's some people have the ass that he's a quote unquote, he's a blue blood, he's a Phipps, I get it. I'm not saying there's nothing there, right? But it's over. It's done with. So yeah. I would hope that we could get to a point where we could put a bow on beating up the past of the Jockey Club or the leadership failures of the past. Okay.
And it kind of goes back to what we were talking about. A little bit of respect and kindness goes a long way. You know, I mean, sometimes, you know, rather than attacking someone online, which I hate that, it's like, you know, I mean, if you don't have, you know, it's like your mother would tell you, if you don't have something good to say, don't say anything at all. And, you know, I think that, you know, this attacking and this infighting isn't good for anybody. You know, if you want to make a change, get involved, make a change, you know, do
absolutely
something, even if it's at a small level, but don't just sit there and throw arrows at the people that are willing to make an effort and try and make a change, especially while, you know, sometimes here's something that I know you got to go, you're up against time constraint, but here's something that I will say I came from outside the industry. I came to this industry from working with, you know, partnerships, branding, sports and marketing, and it brought me into the industry. So I have a little bit of a different view. I work with a lot of other sports, NASCAR, F1, a lot of other, you know, vintage racing. I feel like horse racing draws attention sometimes to the negativity more than they do the positive, because we're always attacking each other. And for people outside the industry, that's what they hear, you know, and that's what they see. Well, and it's got to stop.
Well, I think that's, yes, you're right. The outside industry, but it also, I think just as relevant is that it silences people who have something to say and want to be part of a path of to progress. Meaning,
I agree. Yeah, you're just
meaning like. Do you think like there's some good younger owners in the business? There are several that I think have talked and spoken and given interviews that. Man, they just, you know, you're like, I want to meet this guy. I want to talk. I want to, you know, put our heads together. But unfortunately, I'm afraid that there are plenty of others that don't want to say something and have one of these guys kind of jump on them. And
I agree.
And then have a tourist. So anyway, we're talking about the same thing. It's like we're not going anywhere close to where we need to be and where we want to go to if we don't talk.
We
don't collaborate. And we don't.
At the end of the day, you got to work together. It goes back to what we started in the beginning. You know,
yeah.
What is the military based on? What's most military training based on? It's teamwork and trusting your team.
Yeah.
You can't trust your team when your own team's attacking you. And at the end of the day, the industry is a team. You know, I mean, it isn't going to be somebody from the NFL or Major League Baseball or F1, PGA that comes in and says, "Hey, I'll help you guys." It's gonna you got to do what you can do, and you're just you have a great point. You know, if there's all this infighting and attacks, that's not going to encourage some younger person because they're going to think, "I don't want to draw fire. I don't feel like coming under attack for that." You know, I've got my own life, my own business, my own responsibilities. Why should I bite that off? And, you know, I saw this firsthand. You know, I knew Michael Blowen at Old Friends way back. I mean, from very early, not the very beginning, but very early. And I got to tell you, people were vicious. I mean, I saw it in the beginning. And now he's like the fifth Beatle. But then...
Yeah,
I mean,
very well respected guy.
People, it's like people run from him almost. I mean, and then they'd attack him online and criticize what they were doing. And one thing I will tell you, and I think it's a lesson to be learned, with all of that, and the people around him, including myself, would get probably more angry about it than he would. He always had a smile. He was always polite to everyone. He was always kind to everyone, even the people that attacked him.
Yes.
And I saw that firsthand. I saw people that were downright vicious that later kind of came around. And they were he was very, very gracious to them. And it was kind of a lesson. I kind of thought, you know what, that's really how you should be. Yeah, that's hard to do.
Yeah. That is the true measure of a gentleman. And look, we all get older and we all acquire wisdom, more hopefully more wisdom. And there's certainly plenty of times that I look back and I regret how I acted and how I responded and how I you know, just exactly what you just said. You know, because there have been times I probably would have been one of those guys blowing. And I just say to young people, just be a gentleman or be a gentlewoman and part of the solution. And inevitably things are going to be better when more people do it. And listen, there are times where even the most optimistic of us are, you know, get, you know, frustrated and wonder about this great industry we're in. But that being said, there's a lot of talent in this industry. And you look at the people, you know, I mean, you brought up the series that they came from Formula One. Like, and that isn't embraced in a big way. The gentleman, we've been talking about Formula One for years now, how the Netflix show really transformed the viewership and everything. Well, the guy who put that together, who engineered that transformation, now goes on CNBC a week ago and says, "I want to do the same thing to horse racing." And and some of the leading voices say, "Do you want me to tell you exactly what I think about this?" And you know what the inference is. The inference is that they think it's, well, who knows? Maybe it is a bad idea. But I know one thing.
Well,
they've raised money. They've got some good owners.
The other thing I'll tell you is, I've said this, so again, keep in mind, I'm coming from the outside. I truly believe PGA, and believe me, I work with all of them, not just horse racing. PGA, Formula One, and horse racing have a lot in common. They have more in common than
sure
they
do.
Have.
Yeah.
And I think that that is something that as an industry we should look at, because I'm not trying to be negative in any way, shape, or form, or criticize anybody. But I will say some of these other, you know, like F1 and PGA are a little bit ahead of us in what they do and how they embrace fans and how they attract sponsors and branding. And we can learn from that. I don't mean that as a negative. I mean, learn from it. Look at how they're doing things and try and emulate that. You can't, it isn't the exact same thing, but there are similarities. And I think there are things that would transcend, and that one makes it interesting. One of the things Formula One did, and I'm very involved with F1 Miami, is they really engage people. I mean, it's like a week and a half event leading up to the Formula One race. And I truly wish it was not on the same weekend as Kentucky Derby. I mean, I wish that that was a different weekend.
That's a tough one.
For both sports. I'm not picking on either one. Yeah. I wish it was a different weekend. But they do a big lead up, and it's very interactive. It's very, you know, engaging. And the fans love it.
Yeah.
So well, I know you have to get going.
We have the architect of the Formula One transformation, who has a keen interest in our business and is speaking at the Jockey Club Roundtable. So
I think that's a great start.
That's pretty good. So
that's really good. And, no, I mean, those are the things. And you know what? Those are the things that we need to promote so that people know there are things going on. You know, I mean, there's always the negative. You hear about the negative, you don't hear as much about these things.
Yeah. So, well, listen,
be very
really, really great. And I look forward to seeing you at the races.
I'm really looking forward to it. We got to catch up. We got to sometime, you know, when you're back home or in Lexington, we got to go to Tony's for dinner.
I would love that. You know, there's a Tony's in Bowling Green that I love.
Know. Yeah, you got one right there.
I love Lexington. So, yeah. So, it's all good.
He's a great place. And, you know, he's a huge supporter of the industry. One of the first guys that got behind this show.
Yes. I heard that. Yep. So,
well, I really appreciate it, Terry. Truly an honor to have you. And for anybody who's interested in learning more, West Point Thoroughbred is the place you want to go. It's westpointtb.com. You take a look at them. They have an amazing organization, and they really do a terrific job. And they can, and you know, don't be intimidated by it. You know, they've got a, there's a path for everyone to get into this. And I tell people all the time, horse racing is a great engaging sport. It's very fun. It's something for everybody, whether you want to have a hot dog or beer on the apron, or if you want to get dressed up and take your partner or spouse to, you know, a suite or a restaurant upstairs. There's something for everybody. And I really encourage people in your travels, if you don't live close to one, take a look at any of them around the country. And I guarantee it'll be one of the most engaging afternoons you could have. Terry, I can't thank you enough for joining us. Give my best
my
to your
pleasure.
Family and your lovely wife, and look forward to seeing you soon.
You got it. All
you.
Right. Thanks so much.
Thank you. I really appreciate it. We've been brought to you by Tony's Steak and Seafood, Bowling Green, Kentucky, right by Terry's Place, Lexington, Kentucky, Cincinnati, and Indianapolis. You owe it to yourself to go. Tony's is truly an experience. It's not just dinner. We can't thank Terry enough for joining us today. We also ask you to support the two charities that we support, oldfriendsequine.org. We talked a lot about horse racing on this one. Old Friends is one of the places that some of the racehorses go to after retirement. The other one is No Fallen Heroes. No Fallen Heroes, started by Matt and Susie Buckley. Matt was a former Top Gun pilot, later, you know, adversary instructor. Where I was introducing him as the real life jester from Top Gun. Get a chance, take a look at both those organizations. If you can't do a lot, do a little. Every bit helps. We can't thank everybody enough for joining us today. We really appreciate it. This has been Hollywood and Horsepower, and we will see you guys again next week.
So stay a while. You're in the driver's seat where the road and the rhythm finally meet.
stick around. You never know who's next. And trust me, they got a story worth hearing.